point to start is really to talk about the nature of the collaboration that we've been doing. It's a sort of unusual one, I guess, for historians and people in English departments to be working together on this sort of material. And it came about in late 1999 when I first met Amanda and also her colleague from Flinders, Rick Hosking. And we discovered they were working on that Amanda and Rick were working on much the same sort of material that I was, which is looking at the frontier and the way it was written about and remembered.
Yeah, that's bad.
So we decided to combine our resources, and the result was the book Fatal Collisions, which was published by Wakefield Press in 2001. And what we did in that book was look at a series of case studies of the South Australian frontier, but in a very particular way. We were concerned firstly about what was known to have happened in those events that some of you might know of, the Moriah Massacre, the Rufus River Massacre, the Elliston Massacre and a few other things, but also how it survived in social memory, how communities have recalled those things in later years. Some of you may know Stanner's notion of the Great Australian Silence, the idea that Aboriginal people sort of get written out of the story in the 20th century. But that's less true in regional communities. But what happens is the stories tend to get mythologised. They tend to get, you know, rewritten in a way that often comes through the filter of the pioneer legend. So it was a very productive collaboration, and at the end of it, Amanda and I sort of cast around for a new subject. And we decided upon William Wilshire. Now, Wilshire was a mounted constable who led a detachment of police, of native police, in the Northern Territory, initially in Alice Springs in the 1880s, and then the Top End in the 1890s. And it seemed an ideal subject for collaboration because he was involved in very dramatic episodes and incidents. He was on a frontier where the violence was at its height. But he also wrote about what he did in a series of quite extraordinary books. He dresses them up as anthropological studies, ethnographic studies, if you like, but really they're memoirs, and he's the star of them. So we began work on this project in about 2002 and had a more or less completed manuscript by the beginning of 2005. It took a little while for the publisher to get around to publishing it. So that's a bit of background about the nature of our collaboration. It's an ongoing one. We have other projects we might talk about later on. But I might ask Amanda to talk now. What we'll do is give you a sense of the flavour of the history we write about in the book and read some extracts from the book.
Yeah, this is a kind of round-robin thing where we're going to just give you a little taste of some episodes from the history. And we begin the book with kind of a bit of a backstory before Wilshire arrives in the centre as the commander of the new native police force there. Central Australia, as many people might know, was a very belated frontier in colonial Australia. It opened up at a period when many of the other earlier frontiers had already receded and were turning into the stuff of pioneer reminiscence and colonial, late colonial adventure romance. And the centre really only opened up for pastoral expansion after the Overland Telegraph line was laid down in the early 1870s and made possible the kinds of pastoral excursions to open up the country. And so we begin the book with the first major clash between Aboriginal people and Europeans in the centre, which was an attack on Burrow Creek Telegraph Station. So, yeah, this is a brief extract. Several years before Wilshire's arrival in Central Australia, in February 1874, seven white men and an Aboriginal employee, who were all employees of the Overland Telegraph Line, sat talking in the dusk outside the northern wall of the Barrow Creek Telegraph Station. The Overland Telegraph Line had only recently been completed, and it now linked the entire continent from south to north. It was a tool of the empire that in the coming decade would provide a nodal point for pastoral and mining expansion and mark the beginning of permanent European settlement. But at this stage, Barrow Creek was one of only four isolated stations in the centre that monitored the Overland Telegraph Line and provided a departure point for exploration. As the dusk settled, a large party of Kaidacha men approached from the gully to the south and attacked the station. In the first volley of spears, the station master, James Stapleton, was struck in the chest. The eight Barrow Creek men rushed towards the building's only entrance gate around the corner on the eastern side. Finding the gate blocked by the attackers, they circled the building, but with nowhere to go, they made another dash for the entrance. One linesman was struck by a spear before he reached it and died instantly. Three others, including Stapleton and the Aboriginal employee Jemmy, had been wounded, but seven had now reached the safety of the station building in their Snider rifles. They had trouble taking aim at their attackers through the loophole strategically placed into the fortified structure, but they managed to shoot dead at least two Kaidacha men. Outside, the attacking party retreated, but it didn't leave. Overhead, the line remained intact. The men used it to wire to Adelaide with news of the attack. The closest reinforcements were a travelling line party, 130 kilometres and 2 days' journey away. The Adelaide Telegraph Office buzzed with the need to organise reinforcements for Barrow Creek, and the Commissioner of Police wired the besieged station to tell the men to save their ammunition by only firing with effect. Meanwhile, the station master lay mortally wounded, and before he died, he wired a message to his wife in Adelaide, who'd been brought to the Adelaide head office of the Telegraph Station to receive the message. The other wounded man, Ernest Flint, would recover. Through the telegraph line, a doctor in Adelaide was consulted each hour or so on the treatment of his injury. 4 days later, and after another attack from the Kaidacha party outside, the Tennant Creek Line repair party arrived as reinforcements and relief. Over the next 6 weeks, four punitive expeditions were organised. The Chief Secretary in Adelaide urged the importance of teaching the blacks the consequences to themselves of such wanton and cruel acts of destruction, lest worse disasters follow. The Commissioner of Police also sought quick punitive action for fear that the Aboriginal attackers would pull down the telegraph line and that communication with Australia and the world beyond would be cut off. And he advised that in the police parties that went out, strict adherence to legal forms should not be insisted upon. And in the four punitive expeditions that were led by Mounted Constable Samuel Gayson, a dozen or so Aboriginal fatalities were recorded, but other reports, which are reliable, suggest that the number of Aboriginal lives taken in reprisal for the station attack was between 50 and 90, possibly higher. This was the first large-scale clash between Aboriginal people and Europeans in the Northern Territory. And in a sense, it's just one of numerous such events that came to feed Australia's burgeoning pioneer mythology at the end of the 19th century about hardships endured and overcome in the winning of the country. But the episode resonates with some interesting contradictions. An isolated telegraph station is attacked. Inside this small fortress, several white men and one Aboriginal employee are vulnerable in a vast and at this stage largely uncolonised territory. But the line provides them with the colonial infrastructure in various forms. The dying man speaks to his wife in Adelaide via the telegraph wire. The injured man receives regular medical advice from a metropolitan doctor. And a telegraph party 130 kilometres north learns of the attack from an operator in Adelaide and provides reinforcement to the besieged station. The line brought the entire interior of the continent under the control of the colonial administration in Adelaide and open to the gaze of the empire. At the same time, Central Australia was, in this historical moment, a space on the threshold of a radical change that had not quite arrived.
It was into this world that Wulshi arrived in 1882. It was a place he wanted to go. He, in his 4 or 5 years prior to this, he was gradually moving further north. At this time, his companion officer was Mounted Constable Erwin Wormbrand, of Austrian extraction. And this was typically the way the Mounted Police worked. They were posted to these remote posts in pairs. Others would come to assist them as necessary. The centre was beginning to open up. There were perhaps 8 to a dozen pastoral stations,
We describe it as a very elemental landscape. There are the pastoral stations, there's the telegraph station, there's a mission station nearby, eventually the police arrive. And so a lot of what happens on the frontier is sort of symbolically actually played out in this place. Attacks by Aboriginal people on the stations in the area start to escalate. And then the two attacks in particular, there's an attack on Anna's Reservoir station where two men are badly wounded and the station homestead is burnt down. And then there's, in the top end of the territory, another attack at Daly River where a number of miners are killed. The pastoralists who'd been calling for more police protection redouble their efforts and the government now starts to listen. And what they decide to do is incorporate a type of policing strategy that had been used previously. Been used in South Australia fairly undramatically, but it was well known in Queensland and notorious, and that is the practice of using native police. The native police are under the command of European officers. They're always under their command. They don't operate independently, and they're really a specific type of paramilitary unit that's used on the Australian frontier. Their specific job is to protect pastoralists under the direction of the officers. And so Wulshear is appointed as the head of this native police force. He also forms another one, which he takes up to the top end and establishes there, but comes back to the centre where he now has command of four native police officers, all armed, uniformed, and working under his direction. And I want to read a passage that gives you something of an idea of the nature of frontier policing at this time. Aboriginal people were British subjects, and in theory, equally protected by the law as all other subjects. This was the official rhetoric. When the native police force was established, Wulshear's superior, Sub-Inspector Besley, made the observation that this patrol will have the effect, I'm sure, of keeping Europeans, as well as the blacks, in check. Wulshear and his compatriot Wern Brand understood the rhetoric, but they also understood the reality. Their role was to protect the pastoralists by pacifying the Aboriginal people whose lands were being usurped. As Wulshear put it on one occasion, his duty was to see that the wild natives do not interfere with the white settlers. To achieve this end, they knew they needed and were expected to go beyond the rule of law. Their reports were usually scripted to indicate that due process was being observed, the intention of a raid being to identify and arrest subjects. Identified subjects are duly called upon to surrender. Handcuffs are at the ready. If the suspects are shot, it is described as a last resort of self-defense. Despite this almost formulaic acknowledgement of judicial process, these same reports nonetheless reveal the implicit purpose of patrols. If their task had been simple policing, they would have arrested suspects, yet they rarely report doing so. On two of the rare occasions when suspects are arrested, they were later shot while reportedly trying to escape. Arrests entailed a long and tedious journey south to the local port of Port Augusta. And they did this by camel. One of the very few times Wulshear and Wern Brand undertook this journey with a prisoner happened to coincide with the publication of Wulshear's first book, a book he arranged to have printed at Port Augusta. Wulshear and Wern Brand understood their primary task was not to arrest offenders, but to subdue Aboriginal resistance. The small community they served most directly, the pastoralists, also understood this. In 1890, Robert Warburton, manager of Ordunda Station, wrote a letter to the minister controlling the territory, defending the actions of the police. After reflecting on the violence of early Australian frontiers, he indicated that what was happening at this time in the centre was an inevitable phase of frontier settlement. And quote, "Of course things are difficult and will be until the blacks knuckle under, but not before. When you have subdued them, you can be as kind as you like to them. It's only the same old story of pioneer settlement over and over again ever since Australia was first settled." One of the things we do in this project and in our others is not only look at what happened, but how it's reported. So given that the task the police were implicitly given and the rhetoric they were obliged to observe, how true a record of events were the reports of officers like Wulshear and Wern Brand? In this period, when most of the killings took place beyond the reach of any official inquests, how many reports underestimated the deaths? And how many deaths went unreported? What other sources of information are there? The pastoralists had a vested interest in the native police. The force was established at their request, and they regarded its role as one of, quote, dispersing Aboriginal cattle killers. Dispersing is a term used frequently, and everyone knew at the time it meant shooting. Station managers and their employees were frequently members of Wilshire's and Wormbrand's patrol parties. The missionaries were advocates of Aboriginal people, and they frequently complained about the actions of settlers and police. However, most of their reports of violence were based on what Aboriginal people had told them, rather than on what they had seen. It's hardly surprising that Wilshire, in his reports as well as his published writings, constantly vilified both Aboriginal people and missionaries as liars. So these photographs are taken at the studio in Port Augusta, and one of the things about them is they remind us a lot of the sort of adventure romance illustration that you might find in novels of Rider Haggard, King Solomon's Mine, and so forth. And he knew those works. Is that all?
Oh, yeah. That's, yeah.
So you've shown the three.
Yes.
Okay. So
you,
I'll
go back and look at them.
Pass it back to
Amanda. About the same time as the police became a permanent presence in the centre, the Hermannsburg Mission had established itself not far outside of Alice Springs, and the missionaries came to be a thorn in the side of the mounted constables who commanded the native police force, particularly Wilshire. The missionaries were often the only voices, European voices from the centre, that raised a protest about the actions of the police against Aboriginal people, to the extent that in 1890 a commission of inquiry was established into the actions of the police in the centre. And this had followed a public meeting in Adelaide where the missionaries had re-raised all their concerns about the actions of the police. For instance, they'd said things like, you know, the police are now there in the centre. The police are now there supposedly to protect both the Aborigines and the settlers, but and they may well be stopping the settlers from shooting the Aborigines, but who now is to protect the Aborigines from the guns of the police? So it caused a bit of a furor. Wilshire was asked to report on these accusations, and then he brought forth a whole series of accusations of his own against the missionaries and about their bad treatment of Aboriginal people at the Hermannsburg Mission. And it caused such a kind of back and forth furor in the media, even reaching the newspapers in London, that eventually a commission of inquiry was set up to allegedly look into the actions of the police. But as it turned out, it turned more into an expose of the missionaries. two commissioners were posted to the centre where they interviewed the reverends at the mission, they interviewed police at the police stations, and they interviewed pastoralists and their workers on the pastoral stations. The evidence of the station managers and their men was uniformly supportive of the police and damning of the missionaries. The station managers and their men had a low opinion of the mission, which they regarded as a waste of resources. Most witnesses from the Pastoral Industry Commission commented that there were few Aboriginal residents on the mission and that, in fact, no mission was necessary in the district. The general impression that they conveyed of the missionaries was a cynical one of holy men lacking in compassion. James MacDonald, who was a station manager at Glen Helen Station, said that in 1885, he'd asked Reverend Schwartz to relieve him of all the old and helpless blacks who were resident on Glen Helen Station. And the missionary had replied, "We will take all the young women from your station and you can keep all the old people." When the report was handed down from the commissioners, they found that none of the charges against the police or the squatters, surprise, surprise, were to be proven. The evidence of several German Lutheran missionaries who probably spoke Aranda better than English had been pitched against that of the entire pastoral and mining communities of the district, which had stepped forth in support of the police in general and of Wilshire in particular as its front line of protection against troublesome Aborigines. Instead, the charges found to be proven were those against the missionaries. It had been established, the report said, that chains had been used to detain Aboriginal people on the mission station and that thrashing was resorted to as a punishment. Although it was decided that these actions showed a lack of judgment, they were excusable on the grounds that they were prompted by the kindest motives. In summing up, the commissioners reported that the missionaries had made their statements against settlers and police without careful consideration by acting upon the most unreliable testimony of the Aborigines. Wilshire's conduct in particular, which had been central to the setting up of the inquiry, was, according to most witnesses who were interviewed from the pastoral sector, most praiseworthy. He had done his work well and given satisfaction to the majority of the public. Now, that was the outcome of the Commission of Inquiry in 1890, and when Wilshire republished his book, The Aborigines of Central Australia, in the next year, he gave quite a lot of space to this war of white relations in the centre. He reserved a large measure of his vitriol for the character of Aboriginal people, but most of all for the missionaries. He wrote that the Hermannsburg missionaries were complicit with Aboriginal people in making the interior a more dangerous place. He wrote that the interference of the missionaries only makes the life of the police and pioneering pastoralists more difficult. The settlers hardly know what to do in this kind of country where the wild natives kill their cattle wholesale. Unless they have adequate protection, they must act for themselves, for otherwise there is nothing before them but to abandon the country and leave it to the blacks. The settlers have a difficult enough time dealing with the aggressions of wild natives, but the views and the influence of the missionaries make any serious repression of these outrages impracticable. And he argued that the mission station itself had become a place of retreat and protection for Aboriginal cattle raiding parties. He closes with a parting shot in saying that the Aboriginal people of Central Australia are lazy, treacherous and impure, but on the Fink River, where they ought to know better, that is, at the Hermannsburg Mission, they are worse than the other tribes which live in the surrounding country. He went on at length about, you know, how Aboriginal life is disabled, not because of pastoral settlement, not because of the actions of police, but due to those impious villains and canting hypocrites, the missionaries. Whereas in contrast, the happiest Aboriginal people to be found are those at the police camps. Those who come about the police camps, he wrote, are allowed to move about as they see fit. They are in good spirits and are contented. Those who wish to see a number of blacks who seem really happy should pay a visit to the interior police patrol camp. After the inquiry findings, Wilshire could feel confident that the trials which had dogged his reputation and that of the police force had passed, but in fact they were just beginning.
On the very day that missionary meeting telling Adelaide complained of Wilshire's behaviour, there was an attack on his camp and one of his Aboriginal men was killed. Now, he wants to maintain control, but of course he's suddenly with this mission, you know, debate going on under surveillance, so he can't do anything about it for a while. But in February the following year, in February of 1891, he writes a report to his superiors that two Aboriginal men, Donkey and Roger, had been killed. Now, it just happens that these two people were believed to be the people who killed the person in his camp the previous year, although he doesn't specify this in this report. Now, he wrote that he and the native police went to Tempe Down Station, that they had handcuffs, that their intention was to arrest the culprits, But as they attempted to do so, they resisted and were shot as they resisted. Now, that seemed pretty straightforward. He'd been reporting those sorts of things over and over again. But for some reason, the government decided to institute an inquiry into his events. This had never happened to him before. And it just so happened that there was a parliamentary delegation going through reporting on the pastoral country. And the Attorney General, after getting this report, had gone back. And we've got the notes of this we discovered. It's like this nice little cache. And we went through it, and there's the Homburg's handwritten notes where he's exposing all the contradictions in Wilshire's reports. He says here in the report that they weren't notorious cattle killers. Oh, he says here this happened in November, and then he says here this happened in February. So he wires the telegraph station, is very useful in this story. He wires to South and says, perhaps we should investigate this. And he'd hoped that the pastoral commissioners would do the investigation, but they wouldn't. So he got Frank Gillan, the telegraph station sort of operator, to do so. And so he called in, he had hearings, committal hearing, both at Alice Springs and the Hermannsburg Mission. He interviewed Wilshire. Wilshire told the story about what they had done, intended to arrest them, they resisted, and were shot. And also that these strange Aboriginal people had come in and asked if they could take the bodies away and burn them, and he said, oh, that's okay. Then they interviewed the native police. There were four at this time, there were six a bit later on. And they all corroborated the story, one by one. Yes, we were. He told us to arrest them. He told us to bring handcuffs. And then they went to Hermannsburg, and they interviewed the fourth of the men. The fourth of the men wasn't present with Wilshire, or the other three at the time. And he said, yes, Wilshire told us that we were supposed to go there and to shoot these people. No, we didn't have any handcuffs. We didn't have any leg chains. One person was shot while he slept, and the other shot while he ran away, having been alerted by the shooting. And then they got the camels, and they took the bodies over to some sand hills, piled up some wood, and burnt them. And so Killen's sort of thinking, there's a pretty major contradiction in this story. So he called the others back, and the others came back and said, we're sorry, we lied in our previous evidence, because Wilshire told us to lie. We're afraid that Wilshire would kill us if we didn't tell the story. So then Gillan, who seems to be a very fair-minded person, decided that this was too much and that Wilshire should be committed to trial for the killings. I'll just read you a little observation from South, who other police had come to the district at this point in time. And South, after he had arrested Wilshire, wrote a letter to his superiors in which he said he had always considered Wilshire eccentric, with an inordinate love of notoriety, but he had hardly taken these peculiarities seriously. He simply could not account for Wilshire's actions. And he wrote, unless the result of insanity, surely no sane man, however wicked he may be, would go into a native's camp within 200 yards of a head station and shoot them. Four men and other natives being there at the time, afterwards go and have breakfast at the station, then take the bodies away on a camel and burn them within a quarter of a mile of the station, and not take even the precaution of reporting the matter to a magistrate. Wilshire was put on trial. He was tried by the Supreme Court sitting at Port Augusta. He was defended by a very famous South Australian, Sir Henry Downer. Not a cheap lawyer to get in those days. He had been Premier, he'd been Attorney General, and shortly after the trial he was elected Premier again. And the trial was a bit of a farce. The prosecutor didn't seem to be making a very serious effort to find people guilty. Downer could use all the contradictions, but you said to Gillan that you lied, and so he just kept playing up the fact that, they're liars, how can we trust them? And so, after a 15-minute adjournment, they found there was not a tan of evidence against Wilshire, and he was released. Most people expected that to happen. The very fact that he went on trial indicates the seriousness of it, I think. But there were some other people who were a little less forgiving. Clearly the majority of people would have supported the decision, but some people had some interesting observations to make. One wrote to the press and said that this was an entirely one-sided affair. It is credible that Dylan, who was living near the scene of the murders and was acquainted with previous circumstances connected with Wuxi's treatment of the blacks, should have convicted him for trial without any grounds whatsoever. I was in the north soon after the murders took place, and the universal accepted story was the black trackers shot the unfortunate men, Roger and Donkey, by Wuxi's orders. Everyone was determined Wuxi should be acquitted, and the speech of the counsel for the prosecution might certainly have been that for the defence, and that was certainly true. And then also the Port Augusta Dispatch commented that on the nature and the difficulty of the role he faced. As the case stands at present, we have a police officer appointed to take charge of a corps of native trackers away in the interior. The former has absolute control. In fact, his rule is despotic. The men whom he governs are armed with the most deadly and destructive firearms and have every means to hand for committing crimes secretively in regions far removed from the centres of civilization. Let us put the case plainly. Suppose the officer in charge should be tempted in this indiscreet moment to tumble a few native evildoers head over heels? Who need be any the wiser? So, Wuxi was found guilty, but not guilty, and was released and became a problem for the administration.
And one of the things that we are looking at in this book is the context in which Wuxi is working. It's important that the timing of Wuxi's arrest is important because at this stage, by 1891, Wuxi is arrested for the murder of two Aboriginal men. Whereas for the last decade, he's been working this region with an enormous amount of autonomy and with no administrative intervention whatsoever. He sent reports back to headquarters in Adelaide that are winding up. Oh, that are full of details about Aboriginal deaths with no account of legal formalities being fulfilled. And these reports are all filed away without comment in the police commissioner's office. It's all still there in the state records correspondence files. So something had changed by 1891 that led to this behaviour suddenly becoming a problem. So the way what we're interested in, I suppose, is not so much just Wuxi as a personality, not even particularly as an aberrant personality, but as a man who is useful for that time and place. By 1891, the centre is becoming under much more administrative surveillance, and most importantly, Aboriginal people are becoming central to the success of the pastoral sector. That was something which came out of the Pastoral Lands Commission, which was conducted also in the same year of Wuxi's arrest in 1891, where these pastoral commissioners traipsed around all the stations. The same pastoralists who had been lobbying for a native police force to keep Aboriginal people off their stations 8 years earlier were now saying, yes, we function with Aboriginal. We couldn't function without Aboriginal labour. So the tide had turned, and someone like Wuxi had become, as it were, irrelevant to his own story. He'd worked so efficiently, as it were, that he was no longer necessary, or the centre was no longer that kind of elemental frontier that had a place for someone like him. So after his trial, he was acquitted, but he was a problem and an embarrassment for the police force that no longer wanted someone like him to be working in a region that was increasingly visible. Wuxi was very keen to go back to the centre and applied to do that, but the Commissioner of Police, who had received and filed away all his reports over the last decade without any kind of query, now didn't want him back. But interestingly, although Wuxi was now seen to be an embarrassment and a problem in what was becoming the settled districts, he was still considered a useful man, still for the remote and further flung frontiers. And this is a letter that the Commissioner of Police wrote to Wilshire's superior officer in 1893 when Wilshire was petitioning to be sent back to the territory, to the centre. He wrote, "There is likely to be a vacancy in the Northern Territory Police. Is Mounted Constable Wilshire willing to go there? From what I have seen of his disinclination to submit to authority and his evil example to his comrades, which in the discipline of any station where he is impossible, I feel that I cannot do otherwise than bring his conduct under the notice of the Chief Secretary with a view to his leaving the force. But should he decide, however, on transferring to the territory, I will request Inspector Fulsh to give him a station in the bush on the first opportunity that offers. For although a source of trouble in a station down country, I believe he would be a useful man in the interior." And in fact, Wilshire was sent further north to Victoria River Downs, which was kind of in the northwest of the Northern Territory, and was still a very elemental pastoral frontier in the way that the centre no longer was. But Wilshire was very unhappy there. It didn't serve him well. He no longer felt a master of his own country as he had felt in the centre. He didn't know the country as well. He had trouble settling in there. He had difficulties with authority over the native constables he had charge of. And his reports became increasingly paranoic. And I just want to read you sort of an extraordinarily indiscreet, but for Wilshire, kind of at that stage, quite characteristic report from March 1895, I think. Yes. Where his native constable Jim has deserted him and disappeared into the gorges to follow some Aboriginal employees from the pastoral, the Victoria River Downs pastoral station, who've also disappeared, and they've taken guns from the police stores. And he writes to his superior officer, "So you see how matters are, as all sorts of conspiracies are going on. My anxiety at present is very great. Four civilised black boys adrift, all good shots, with three rifles and one revolver. I do not know what moment they may decamp in the dark. There is something hanging in the atmosphere that so far I have failed to discover. Perhaps it's an attack on this station or one of the other stations. It's not safe for one to go far away, although I should like to track Jim and get the rifle and the revolver. As for our Jim, he's a most deceitful liar with an oily tongue. Whatever may be the ultimate outcome of this, I cannot say, but I look to you for protection from any lying slander that this oily-tongued absconder may cause. I was always kind but very firm with him, but long ago there's no gratitude in them, and friendship they are unable to appreciate. The only redeeming features he possessed was that he was a fairly good shot and a good tracker. To say the least of it, this is a rough place with treachery all around you, and when black boys belonging to the country turn out with firearms, matters are getting tropical." And he concludes this quite extraordinary report with the stated intention to go out tomorrow and look them up, and I promise you I will do my duty out to the very last in the open.
Wilshire was not a happy man. He applied to be transferred south, and it was eventually agreed that, yes, he would get that transfer. What we do in the next part of the book is essentially write him out of the story, because his story after that point is one of a simple country copper. He comes back to Adelaide, eventually gets posted to Eyre Peninsula. He's there at Port Lincoln for a while, at Cowell, and later a few other regional postings, but most of the time on Eyre Peninsula. It's there that he marries and has a couple of children, one of whom, in his inimitable style, his first daughter he names Victoria River. It's a mundane life. His journals from Cowell are almost as extensive as his journals from the north. You know, the journal from Victoria River Downs is extraordinary for the language and the confessional sort of quality of it. The ones from Cowell went and policed the local race meeting, went to the local Institute Hall, dealt with a rabid dog. You know, it's that sort of, literally that sort of work. And in chapter 10 of this book, what we do is we shift to the other threads that we've been looking at, the mission. Now, the mission shortly afterwards closed down. The people were struggling so much, the missionaries were so sick, they just packed up and they left. It was reopened later on, but a few years later. The other thread is anthropology. Anthropology is emerging as a discipline at this time. And Gillen, who is the one who committed Wilshire for trial, becomes famous for his partnership with Spencer and becomes admired amongst Aboriginal people. There's a shift in policy away from an assumption that people are dying out, Aboriginal people are dying out, to one that, oh, they're not, it seems. They seem to be growing in numbers. And so you get interventionist sort of legislation being introduced. And in fact, in 1907, they're going to introduce a new act, an Aborigines Protection Act, and they're looking for the job of a new protector. And lo and behold, Wilshire applies for that job. He's quite brazen. He doesn't get the job, surprise, surprise. Interestingly, the job goes to Mounted Constable South, the man who had arrested him earlier on. And one of the points we make here is that as strange and as extravagant as Wilshire is, his ideas were becoming orthodoxies by this time. His ideas about race, about miscegenation, about Aboriginal policy, were the sorts of things that were being introduced. But people like South didn't use the sort of extravagant language that he used. But nonetheless, he, you know, the sort of ideas he'd espoused were becoming orthodox. So Wilshire lived out the rest of his life in relative obscurity. And interestingly, his last job was as night watchman at the abattoirs. So I think it's quite ironic that he ended his career supervising the killing of cattle. The epilogue of the book, we deal with the way Wilshire's been remembered. And I always think it's interesting, you know, that he wanted to be known. His name is inscribed on Chambers pillar in huge letters in several places. And I also find it, again, ironic that Wilshire Street in Alice Springs happens to be a safety house zone.